Well, good morning, church.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. Good to be together, as always. I know it's the start of fall breaks, and a lot of folks are out of town, so my wife told me to make sure that I brought one of my B sermons this morning so that nobody missed out on much of anything. So this is what I assume B was for best. So I'm going to give you my B sermon this morning. We've had a lot of things going on at Forest Mill, and I am so thankful for you all and for the ministry leaders that we have. And it's a great time to be a part of the Forest Mill Church, in my humble opinion. It's a good time to see new Christians and seasoned Christians, people who have been Christians for some time, working together and doing great things and representing Christ to one another, representing Christ to our community as well. Now, one of the things that I don't think I've ever shared with you, but I do love a good Western. I don't know how many of you are Western fans, but it's one of my very favorite genres of movies. They don't come out very often anymore, but I mean, High Plains Drifter or Pale Rider or Open Range or Three Amigos, just good classic Westerns. I love them. But let me tell you something that a lot of those movies, in fact, many of those movies have in common. I'm just going to spoil it for you. There's an outsider, usually a stranger, rides into a town that's suffering under the reign of someone who is not a good person. Could be an outlaw gang or a corrupt mayor or sheriff or a wealthy land baron. But the identity, you know, the identity of the bad guy may vary, but they all kind of have the same result. They all treat the residents badly. They're stealing or swindling or running them off or even killing them. That's what bad guys do. And there always comes this point where the protagonist, the good guy, could be Clint Eastwood or Kevin Costner or Steve Martin, you know, whoever, and the good guy has to face down the bad guys. They got to stand up for what's right. You know, it's one of those moments where the bad guy will say something along the lines of, you know, this town ain't big enough for both of us, or what gives you the right to be doing all this, or who do you think you are, or this is my town, that sort of situation, right? It's a power struggle of might versus right. And that's exactly the sort of scene that we face this week in the Gospel of Mark. It's a power struggle. Now, early on in his gospel, and if you were here with us for the beginning of this Mark study back in 2016, we know that you probably remember that Mark spent a lot of time early on in his gospel establishing the authority of Jesus. He's emphasizing how Jesus has the authority to teach and say what he does. He had the authority to say things unlike anybody else. He had the authority to heal the sick. He had the authority to cast out demons. He even had the authority to raise the dead. It was clear Jesus is different. Jesus is not like any other rabbi, any other teacher. And people were drawn to Jesus. People listened to Jesus because all of that comes across. He does not talk as all of these other teachers. He speaks as one with authority, right? That's what was said about him. So when Jesus comes in earlier in Mark 11 here, towards the end of the gospel, we talked about it a couple weeks ago. Jesus comes into the temple and he runs off the moneylenders. You remember that? He goes into the temple, he overturns tables and runs those people out of the temple. It was different. It was not like, you know, walking through downtown today and you see a homeless person who runs through a market upturning things. What would people do? Well, they just pick up their stuff and put it back, right? Because this crazy person or this homeless person or this angry person does not have the authority to tell them to close up shop. So when Jesus does it, people pay attention. They close up shop. Not like Jesus is some ranting lunatic. Not like he's some crazy person who's just running around flinging stuff everywhere. They're like, oh, he's telling us to get out. I guess we better get out. And so they do. They evidently leave this plying their trade in the temple. And so because Jesus has done this, Jesus has questioned the status quo, right? He's dared to defy the decisions of the religious leaders. So because of that, here we are at that scene. Just like the Westerns, we got a showdown. And it's not Jesus against the crowds. It's Jesus versus the people in charge. And this is what we read in Mark chapter 11, beginning of verse 27. They arrived again in Jerusalem, right? Because he didn't stay there. He was staying outside of town. So he leaves town. He comes back. They arrived again in Jerusalem. And while Jesus was walking in the temple courts, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders came to him. You get that? Three groups? Chief priests and scribes and elders? Those are the three people that make up the Sanhedrin, the three groups of people. The Sanhedrin is the ruling religious body. That is who makes all decisions for all things religious. This chief priests, scribes, and elders. So they come and they confront him. And they say, by what authority are you doing these things? Meaning, throwing people out of the temple. And who gave you the authority to do this? So Jesus replied, I'll ask you one question. And if you answer me, I'll tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. So here's the question. John's baptism, was it from heaven or was it of human origin? Answer me. They discussed it among themselves. And they said, look, if we say it's from heaven, then he's going to ask, why didn't you believe him? If it's from heaven, why didn't you believe him? But if we say John's baptism was of human origin, well, they feared the people. For everyone else held, all the people held that John was a prophet. So they answered Jesus, we don't know. And Jesus said, neither will I tell you by what authority I am doing these things. So this group of people, these religious leaders, the Sanhedrin, they had authority on all religious matters, especially as it pertained to proper conduct in the temple. If you wanted to know if you could do something in the temple, this is who you asked, right? So when Jesus comes into the temple telling people who can and who can't do what, Jesus is all up in their business as far as they're concerned. And it's flying all over. You can hear it in the way that they question him. They say, who gave you the authority to do these things? By implication, what they're really saying is, look, we didn't give you the authority to do this. We're the ones who would give you the authority to do this, and we didn't do that, so who do you think you are? I mean, what do you think you're doing? That's what they're really asking Jesus. They're doing it all nice and polite, but this is a confrontation. So as short as this story is, and we've read the whole story now, by the way. We got the whole thing. As short as this story is, it's a very dramatic moment. It is the same showdown that Jesus has been talking about for most of this gospel. It's what Jesus has been alluding to. Remember when Peter first called Jesus Messiah? Jesus said, who do you say I am? And who do people say that I am? And they said, yeah, you know, some people say Elijah, John the Baptist, or a prophet. Jesus said, who do you say I am? And Peter said, I say you're the Christ, the Son of God, right? Remember that confession? And Jesus, right after that, said, you're right. And he goes on to say, but I tell you what is going to happen. Because I'm the Christ, there's going to be people out to get me. Because I'm the Christ, because of what I say, because of what I do, there are going to be ramifications, and the chief priests and the scribes and the elders, the religious leaders, are coming for me. He's been talking about it since all the way back then. And immediately after that, so true to this prophecy that Jesus made, the face-off has now begun. It's a little like, maybe you went to school with people like this. You know, you went to school with at least one guy, and maybe one girl, but for sure, at least one guy, that if he says we're going to fight, we're going to fight. You know what I'm talking about? They say something along the lines of, if you do that one more time, I'm going to see you in the parking lot after school. Maybe you went to school with people, maybe you went to school with better people than I did. I don't know. But I definitely went to school with that guy. And so now, here we are. We are in the parking lot. Jesus has done something they did not want him to do, and so it is about to go down. And they touch it off by questioning Jesus' authority to do what he's done. Now, in Mark's gospel, the word authority is really important. Really important in Mark's gospel. Authority in Mark's gospel never, never, never has to do with human authority. It never does. Like if I come to you and you're setting up a lemonade stand in front of your house, your kids are selling lemonade, and I say, by what authority are you doing this? You're like, well, there's no permits. This is Coffee County. Nobody cares. Right? But in some places, it's a big deal. You'd have to have a permit. You'd have to have some food inspection or something along those lines. And you would say, look, I've got this piece of paper here and I've got this piece of paper there. It's all about the legal or the human authority. In Mark's gospel, it's never about the legal or the human authority. It is always about God's authority. It's always about the divine order. Are you doing what God said you could do? Are you doing what God said? So that's the authority they're talking about. So they come and they question Jesus' authority, and Jesus immediately sort of turns the table and asks them a question. And so he tells them, you answer me, right? Even as they're questioning Jesus' authority, Jesus sort of maintains his authority even over them. And he says, you answer me. And you know what's bizarre is they do it. Like, by answering him, they are showing Jesus has that sort of authority. Because he's taking command even of them in the situation. Now, I'll grant you, this is a pretty traditional way that rabbis taught. Jesus wasn't the only one who taught this way. This method of teaching by answering a question with a question. Maybe you grew up this way. You had to learn the Socratic method. Anybody ever? Just me. Okay, anyway, it's called the Socratic method, and it was a traditional Greek way of teaching. Rabbis often did it as well, answering a question with another question. So if you were smart and a good teacher, then somebody came up and asked you a question, you could ask them a question, and while they're answering that question, they would figure out their own answer. Does that make sense? Like, if my kids came to me and said, you know, Dad, can I go to my friend's house and we're going to go around and have a big party? And I might answer that. My kids never asked me that, by the way, but let's just pretend that they did. They came in and asked me that. And I would say, well, do you think that sounds like something God would want you to do? And they could answer that question and say, well, in answering that question, they answered their own question. So even more broadly, they asked Jesus a question, so he asked them a question back, which should give them the answer to their own question, right? So he asks them about the baptism of John. And asking about the baptism of John, it's not just about the baptism. It's sort of a shorthand way of saying the ministry of John, what John was doing there. So when John the Baptist comes along preaching about baptizing for repentance, and John taught them, he says that you're going to be following one greater than me. Everybody needs to follow the one who's coming after me. He says, was John just making that stuff up, or was he saying that was from God? Was that from God? In other words, was John a fraudster or was John a prophet? You've got to decide now. So here in this gospel, they're trying to debate that. Now in Acts 5, the Sanhedrin, same religious body, they're debating what to do about the Jesus movement. Maybe you've heard this story before. And Gamaliel, really wise teacher in the Sanhedrin, and he says, we ought to leave this Jesus movement alone because if it's from God, we can't stop it. And if it's from man, it's going to fall apart. That was his reasoning. That's sort of what happens right here. So that's the dilemma that they find themselves in. They're thinking about the ministry of John. Let's say, if we say that John's ministry was from heaven, from God, people are going to ask, Jesus is going to ask, why didn't we follow it? And if we say that John's ministry was just man-made, made up, fairy tale fiction from men, if just some unauthorized man-made teaching, then the people are going to turn on us because they believe John. So that's their dilemma. Say it's from heaven and we get in trouble for not following him. Say it's from men and people are going to know that we think they're stupid for listening to John. So they think John is a loon. They think John the Baptist is a crazy guy in the desert wearing camel's hair cloak, leather belt, eating wild locusts and honey. That's what they think. And it's on the surface, it looks like that, right? They think there's no way anybody should be from God out there doing that. We don't think John knows God's will from a hole in the ground. We think John is that crazy. But they can't say that out loud. Because if they say that out loud, they're going to lose their authority. So unfortunately for them, their reasoning, just like a good question would do, reveals exactly where their authority comes from. That their authority is not from heaven. Their authority is from the crowd. Does that make sense? They're not wondering, what does God say about John's ministry? They're wondering, what does the crowd say about John's ministry? If they were under God's authority, if they were operating with God's authority, they wouldn't care what everyone else thinks. They would just say, what does the Lord say about this? But they're not wondering what the Lord says about this. They're wondering what y'all out there think about this. Because I got to tell y'all what all y'all want to hear, or else I'm going to be out. It's like an elected official in October. They don't have a stance on anything. They're wondering what your stance is, and then they'll say that's theirs. So, in Tennessee, everybody's kind of got to argue about being the most this. Oh, that guy says he loves guns. He doesn't love guns. Look at this right here. I've got six. I mean, it's like they can't argue enough about that. And in California, it's like, that person says they love the LGBT community, but I've got six wives and seven husbands. I really love LGBT. I don't know. You have to tell me how it goes there, Joe. But anyway, the point is, in different markets, people are arguing about who's the most this and the most that. That's the whole point. Doesn't matter what's true. Doesn't matter what's good. Doesn't matter what's right. The point is, you have to appeal to the masses. And that's what religious authorities should never, ever, ever be doing. Religious political authorities, it makes sense. Look, they're just saying what they're saying so they can have some authority in civil government or in society. But in God's religious authority, it's not supposed to be that way. If someone's truly from God, they're not going to be doing this, licking their finger and sticking it up to the wind, wondering which way the wind is blowing. Political authority, sure. Commercial authority, people who are running companies, totally makes sense that they would be doing that. Totally makes sense that both of those would. But people who are from God shouldn't be doing that. So they have to give the only answer that's left to them. They've got to say, well, we don't know. Now, to you and I, this sounds like a smart move. To say we don't know sounds like a smart move, but they're not in our culture. They're in a shame and honor culture. So for a religious authority to admit they don't know where John's baptism is from, it's a humiliation. It's a loss of faith. It's a loss of face. And you can almost see the sin. I mean, for them, this is like when you walk in and flip the light on your kitchen and your kids got their hand in the cookie jar. And you're like, and maybe you've had this happen to you. I know that I have. You say, what are you doing? And what is the response? I don't know. That's what they're sort of doing. They're sort of like all shucks in, looking at the ground. Where does John's baptism come from? I don't know. You know, it's like, this is not my fault. This has nothing to do with me. They're trying to get out of it. They have no authority here, and they know it. And now, because they've admitted they don't know, the crowd can know it. So they are saying, we are unable to discern spiritual matters. So that invalidates their claims to lead the people. How can God's shepherds shepherd God's flock if they cannot discern his will? How can these people command everyone to follow their directions when they don't know which way God is? They're saying, follow me to God. I don't know where God is. I'm not sure if he's with John or not, but follow me to God. And more importantly, what we're seeing here is that even though Jesus' authority is clearly from heaven, some people have no ability to see it. They refuse to see it. It's not just that they can't see it. They refuse to see it. And that's the hard thing, isn't it? I mean, here's Jesus. Imagine you were one of these religious leaders. Here's Jesus. He is standing like right in front of you. You are this close to Jesus. You can see him with your own eyes. You can hear him with your own ears. You can have a conversation with Jesus face to face. They have all of that, and they cannot see that Jesus is the Christ. They have seen Jesus heal the sick. They have seen Jesus teach like nobody else. They've seen the blind receive sight, the deaf receive hearing, the lame walk again. They have all the evidence there right in front of them, and they cannot see him. So this is not just that they don't see it. It's that they refuse to see it. It's not an intellectual problem. It's a heart problem. We might say that they were hard-headed, but it's not just that they're hard-headed. It's worse than that. It's worse than just being stubborn. It is self-inflicted blindness. It's like telling your kids, look at me. Like when you're trying to get something across, look at me. And they go, I can't see you. Right? That's what they're doing. Jesus is saying, look at me. And they're covering their eyes, covering their ears, saying, I can't see. It's that self-inflicted blindness. In fact, that's why in Matthew's gospel, Jesus calls them that. He calls them blind guides, people who are attempting to lead others to God who have no clue where God is. It's what makes religious leaders, of all the different kinds of leaders, there's a bunch of different kinds out there, but of all the different kinds, it's what makes religious leaders the most dangerous. Because religious leaders are doing it in the name of the Lord. I would argue that makes them more dangerous than any political leader, any leader of industry or science or intellectualism, because they're doing it in the name of the Lord. And anyone who says, follow me to the way of the Lord, just be ready. Just be ready. And that's one of the things that makes me so thankful for our leaders here at Forest Mills. Really, our elders, I am so thankful for them. I have been in ministry now for about 30 years, full-time ministry. about 30 years. And I came in with a big group of people. Like, there were several guys, a bunch, dozens and dozens and dozens. Just this last week, a guy who was my college roommate was fired from his however many, at least his second church job and his last. He just can't take it anymore. And that's the story that I get over and over. People who go into ministry and work under elders, under leaders that are really, not to speak badly about other people, but those guys are dysfunctional. Our elders aren't fully functional, but they are not dysfunctional. No. For real, we have the best elders I have ever been, and I've worked with several good elderships, several. But I am so thankful for our elders. And here's not because they have all the right answers, not because they have it all together, but I will tell you that our elders, instead of trying to consolidate power for themselves, which many religious leaders do, they are trying to find ways to empower you for the ministry of Christ. Instead of tearing others down who disagree with them, which a lot of religious leaders do, they are finding ways to agree and build people up. Amen. Instead of asserting their own authority, they are submitting to the authority of Christ, even when it makes them look like not the smartest guys in the room. Because they're not interested in self-promotion. They're interested in Christ's promotion. They're not interested in being the biggest or the wealthiest or the most powerful. They are interested in being the most like Jesus in leading a congregation of people in that same direction. So I'm so thankful for our elders. And my prayer for you all, my prayer for us is that we might submit to the authority of Christ even as they're attempting to submit to the authority of Christ. Not because we are worth more or smart more or more smarter or not because we have it more together or more right answers, but because we need Christ's authority over our own inability. And that's what Jesus does. He takes humble people like our elders, like you and like me, and when we submit to his authority, he can work wonders. So this morning, if we can pray for you, encourage you, lift you up for strength, for forgiveness, for direction and guidance, we want you to do that now. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?